calling roll.
Oh.
Excuse me.
We're all here. Our new on-air sign isn't on, though, so are we recording?
Oh, I meant to put that on last time. I forget. We have an on-air sign now in the studio so that we know when we're recording.
Good plan. It works quite well when you turn it on.
Yeah.
So the last thing we recorded, who knows? Maybe it wasn't.
I have a fear that it might be gone forever, but, you know. Because the last re-recording that we did was Roskilde, and remember that episode got a little bit fucked up? Because it sped up to, like, double speed?
And then I had to slow it back down, and so there's, like, some artifacting in the audio there.
Yeah. Oh, well.
Sorry
about
that, guys.
It doesn't matter. Who cares? Well, let's not talk about the past. Let's talk about the future, because this is season motherfucking six of
our
podcast. Yeah.
Holy cow.
I was going to say five again, and then I looked at it, and I was like, oh, shit, we are on season six. We've been doing this show, I think, since 2021. Yeah, we've got, at this point in time, we've got over 100,000 downloads of our show by our awesome fans who love us. This year, you've heard us saying our plan is to release one full episode every month. We are well on our way to doing that, and we're also getting some re-recordings in here of season one and two here and there. So we do have a re-recording of Mindy McCready coming right up. We'll let you know when that one drops. And thanks to everybody who let us know we were in your Spotify Wrapped. We were the top podcast for like over 200 people or something.
That's so cool.
It was really cool. So we were in the top 10 podcasts for over 2,000 listeners. We were in the top 5 for 1,200. And we were the number one podcast for 263 fans.
Wow. Round up to 300.
Yes, for 300 fans. Thank you guys for listening. And today we're going to cover somebody that has been asked for, it's been asked that we do this one several times, and we even had somebody be rude about it, but initially it was Drew Fowler who sent us an email and said, please cover Randy Rhodes.
Well, you better still be listening too, so.
I swear to God, I'll email him back, I'll send him the link when it comes out, if I remember, so that he will listen. And then he can send it to all of his friends and family and be like, I was mentioned on a podcast that has over 100,000 downloads. So, like, I'm famous.
Yeah.
Anyways, thanks, Drew, for suggesting this one because Jake thought this guy was a wrestler.
It sounds like, I don't know. You know, I'm here for emotional support. And I didn't know that, like, I thought, why are we going into the sports thing that we talked about? Because it sounds like, I don't know who this man. Who is this man?
Okay. But the initial thing was, we mentioned when Drew sent us the email that he wanted us to cover Randy Rhodes. I knew he was a guitarist, knew he was in metal, thought he played with Black Sabbath. That was not him. I knew he was affiliated with Ozzy Osbourne.
Very close.
I didn't listen to Black Sabbath. I didn't listen to Ozzy, really, just in passing. Anyways, I knew the affiliation was there. Jake said, isn't that guy a professional wrestler? However, he's thinking of Dusty Rhodes.
Yeah.
Anyways, different guy. Today we're talking about Randy Rhodes. And Jake and I took over research for this one. And now we're going to talk about it. Did you introduce us?
And well, I was about to say, we should probably tell them who we are this point.
That's your job. See, Here's the problem. The problem is...
Is you Cassie's, talk too much.
No, shut the fuck up. I'm talking. The problem is
case in
that
point.
Cassie's back.
Uh-huh.
And so... When we already recorded one episode today, and me and Cassie were just going on and on and on because we haven't talked in so long.
Right.
And Jake was just quietly sitting in his corner, not even attempting to say anything because now
it's
easy.
Difficult to interject between the two of you.
Do we need to slow down?
No.
Maybe we need to breathe more in between sentences.
Probably.
Why would I do that?
To create space for Jake to say something.
Why would I agree? No.
I think we'll be good on this episode because you didn't get into this document and put in any writing. So you're just here. You're going to be live reacting and we're going to be going through what we have written down.
Yeah, it's been hard trying to tackle everything at home and then also a baby.
Yeah.
So
you tackle
the baby. Yeah,
it's not
that difficult to tackle a baby.
No, he's not injured. No, I'm not going to.
You can
say that.
Punt a baby. I'm
not going to.
Honestly,
no.
Your baby's kind of linebacker size.
He
so.
Is.
He is.
He's
very
half
large.
My height already, so he's 15 months. So.
Yeah. Anyways, listening to Death by Music Podcast. I'm Jake.
Come
I'm here
on,
with
Jake.
Alex and Cassie.
Hey.
Welcome, folks.
All right. So, sources here. Were Wikipedia. There was a grunge.com article by William J. Wright. And
yep.
Jake.
I used Randy Rhoads' Reflections of a Guitar Icon, a 2022 documentary. I used a Louder Sound article by Paul Elliott, a Blabbermouth article with no author listed. There is a YouTube channel that I found called Taking Off, and they have a video specifically about what happened to Randy.
Ooh.
That's the channel if you want to go check it out. And okay. You can, well, we'll talk about that later.
Obviously.
I mean, yes.
Yeah. After we tell the story.
Right.
It'll be at the end of the story.
We're learning together in
real
time.
Surprise, surprise.
I'll let you know when we get to that part where I got the information from that video. So.
All right. So, getting older and outliving the 27 Club has been eye-opening. Growing up, you hear stories about Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and company, but they somehow seem much older to me.
Yeah.
Maybe because their legacies are so huge. But it's hard to imagine dying at such a young age. And on this show, we've actually covered a handful of musicians who met their fate even younger than that. Today, it's going to be Randy Rhoads, who was taken from us at age 25. In his short time on Earth, he managed to influence a generation of guitarists and play with some of metal music's greatest legends. It's impressive to see how strong of an impact his fast and technical playing had on metal. And unfortunately, we'll never know what else he could have accomplished had he survived. Randall William Rhoads was born to two music teachers in Santa Monica on December 6th, 1956, the youngest of three kids. Randy's dad, William, played clarinet and saxophone in the Army. Sounds like a nerd. While his mother, Dolores, was a multi-instrumentalist and studied under bandmaster Herbert Lincoln Clark.
Hold on. Wait a second. The Herbert Lincoln Clark, world-famous cornetist, Herbert Lincoln Clark, played with John Philip Sousa in his marching band, Herbert Lincoln Clark.
I guess.
Nice.
Something tells me you didn't know that until this very moment.
They didn't, because I just told them.
Oh. Yeah.
Anyways, his parents were both musicians and teachers. They founded the Musonia School of Music in North Hollywood in 1949. A year and some change after Randy's birth, his parents divorced. The kids stayed with their mother, Dolores, while she ran the School of Music, while his father left and later remarried.
Musonia is actually still open, and it's being run by Randy's brother, older brother, Kelly. And according to the website, you can book a tour and still get lessons if you want.
Cool.
Yeah.
The family didn't have a stereo or a TV, so the kids made their own music to keep busy. Randy's mother said that the lack of outside influences helped foster his creativity.
Yeah.
Randy and his brother Kelly would play Beatles and Stones tunes in their garage as kids. Kelly said, "One day when my brother was a little tiny kid, like 5 years old, he was snooping around in our mother's closet, and the guitar that belonged to my grandfather, a 1918 Gibson Army Navy Special, fell down and hit him in the head."
Glad it was that. Not something else.
About a year later, when my mom saw that he was serious, she gave him lessons in acoustic guitar. Randy picked up folk and classical guitar lessons at the age of 7. He started taking lessons at his mother's music school from Scott Shelley. And this dude actually came to Randy's mom to let her know that the kid was better than him after only 9 months of training, and he could no longer teach him.
That's fucking nuts. You know, it makes me wish I had stuck with guitar as a kid.
Do you think then Randy was like, "I'll actually teach the class now. You can sit down for
girl,
me.
You I... just fucking wait," because yes, yeah. That's exactly what happened.
Yep.
Yeah, pretty soon Randy became an instructor at the school as a fucking teenager.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, Randy's mom taught him piano in the meantime to expand his knowledge of music theory.
But then that teacher could be like, "I taught him everything he knows," but then he kind of surpassed
but,
me.
But he knows so much more.
Yeah.
While in middle school, Randy met Kelly Garney, and the two became best friends. Garney said they were outcasts because of, quote, "the way we looked. Every time we showed up for school, it was usually problematic, so we pretty much avoided it. We weren't nerds, we weren't jocks, we weren't dopers, we were just on our own." Garney learned to play bass from Randy, and they formed a band called The Whore.
Whore, whore, whore. Sorry, inside joke. Kate will understand that joke.
Oh, okay.
Kevin also. You can cut that out if you need to.
Oh, no, I won't cut it out. Shout out to Kate, who sent us some more cheese recently.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah.
That,
is it gone?
Mostly, yes.
I mean, you can dress them if you want. It's probably, like, mostly mold
at this
point.
Cheese is mold.
What we didn't polish off, so.
That's fine.
Yes. During this time, Randy refined his lead guitar skills. He started playing around town at local parties.
Yeah, that seemed to be the thing back then in L.A., in the L.A. rock scene. He says he couldn't wait for the weekends, though, so he could just play. He and Kelly would show up, and they'd find a drummer, and they'd just sit there and jam for the whole party or whatever it was they were at.
Then the little group they had linked up with Randy's brother on drums. They formed a cover band called Violet Fox. They would do Stones, Mountain, Alice Cooper, and David Bowie songs. After that group dissolved, Randy was in a bunch of different bands. He was consuming tons of music on the radio. He was listening to bootleg recordings of different bands live. And then Randy got to see an icon, which I'm seeing with my own two eyes right here.
Yes.
Alice Cooper, live at the Long Beach Auditorium on July 11th of 1971. And Jake has pasted a photo here of Alice Cooper wearing nothing but a snake.
Jake.
Sorry.
This Alice Cooper show was life-changing. Randy knew that this was what he wanted to dedicate his life to. Kelly said of that occasion, Randy was mesmerized. He was catatonic. He was just staring at the stage. Later that night, Randy said, I can do this. I can look like this. I can be this. Something clicked that night, and I think that kind of showed him what he could do with his talent. Unfortunately, still got to go to school.
Bullshit.
However, Randy was obviously smart as heck, and he got good grades. He didn't even have to try.
You know, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I could have done that if they'd ever taught anything worth learning. I'm heckin' smart.
I feel like you say that every time we mention that someone finished high school.
In fact, the last episode we recorded 30 minutes ago, I said that.
Fucking thing. Cassie, you've said that in a handful of episodes as well.
Really?
College.
College is dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There we go.
Nobody needs it.
So Randy graduated from high school at age 16, like Mindy McCready. After participating in an accelerated program, he was able to focus on music full time. Randy had basically mapped out his musical career, and he planned exactly how he was going to get what he wanted. He formed the band Little Women with Kelly Garney. Taught guitar at his mom's guitar school by day and played gigs at night. Soon, Little Women recruited Kevin DeBrow for vocals and Drew Forsyth for drums and changed their name to Quiet Riot.
Ah, come on, feel the noise. Look, Drew, so Jake added more pictures. Drew's hair is so luxurious in this photo. It's like a glamour shot for this man.
It looks great.
It is so feathered.
I don't know what they were doing to their hair. They must have all been blow drying their hair because, like, how did people's hair fall differently in the 70s and than it does now? Like, I don't get it. There was some tension in the band, though. Kevin DuBrow was on vocals, and he was not exactly what Randy had in mind for a lead singer. He wanted more of a personality, like a David Bowie or an Alice Cooper, and that was not Kevin at all. But he did share the same sort of drive as the others, so they let him stay.
Kevin DeBrow hadn't had any live performance experience at this point either.
Yeah, so. I imagine you have to take a lot of time to build up that sort of confidence on stage.
Right.
Because nobody just goes up there and is a Freddie Mercury, Freddie Mercury.
Right.
I mean, he was like nervous as hell and just awkward on his first couple performances.
Mm-hmm. I would be too.
Yeah. Quiet Riot, they were killing it at the LA club scene, and they were signed by 1976 to Sony Records. Since Kevin was boring as hell, Randy basically became the focal point of the group. He created their signature look, which was polka dots. And soon, fans started showing up to Quiet Riot shows wearing polka dot bow ties and vests. Word was getting around about how badass Rhodes was on guitar, and so fans started coming out in droves to see what it was all about. Coming up at the same time, we're fellow hair metal boys in Van Halen. And I'm wearing a Van Halen shirt right now, actually. I feel kind of bad. The two groups had a friendly but intense rivalry develop before either group was signed. Van Halen hooked up with Warner Brothers in 1977 and hit gold with their debut. Quiet Riot's two self-titled Sony albums were only released in Japan.
Also, before hitting it big, friends say that they would actually see David Lee Roth and Eddie Van Halen at Quiet Riot shows, but Randy never went to see them. All the while, Randy, you know, obviously he's still teaching guitar at Musonia, and his students would come to him wanting to learn Van Halen songs. So he'd have to learn Eddie's stuff so he could instruct them.
It probably was not hard for him.
No, they did end up playing one show together on April
Thirst.
Oh, somebody caught that. All right. Yes, April 3rd, 1977, and they couldn't decide who was going to be the headliner until Van Halen got their record deal first.
Yeah.
So they ended up headlining that show.
That makes sense. They couldn't seem to secure a deal in the United States, and Kevin and Kelly could not get along. Kelly said, "I was on a constant quest to get him out of the band and get a different singer. I hated him. He hated me, and we could not find any way whatsoever to get along," which caused a lot of tension in the band.
Yeah.
And it put a lot of stress on Randy to try to be neutral. And this seems to be like a theme throughout the rest of his life, is just to... He's the guy who's there to play music and everyone else is just fucking bitching.
Right.
During the recording of Quiet Riot 2 in 1977 and 78, tensions hit a fever pitch between Kevin and Kelly. Kelly Garney, on one particular night, got drunk as fuck and stole liquor from a bar, then unsuccessfully tried to convince Randy to fire Kevin.
Yeah, Kelly had a bit of a drinking problem at this time and wasn't really pulling his weight with the group. Later on, Randy and friend of the band, Kim McNair, that's a guy, Kim, went over to Kelly's place to try and get Kelly to turn things around and get his act together, learn his parts in the songs, and take things seriously. Unfortunately, things didn't work out how Randy had hoped.
Kelly literally fired a handgun through the ceiling. Yes, they were inside when this happened. And then got into a fist fight with Randy over the matter. Then he had the bright idea to drive across town, yes, still drunk as fuck, and kill Kevin DeBrow.
You're serious.
Why?
As he was recording vocals for the album. Thankfully, Kelly, it's funny because it didn't happen. Thankfully, Kelly was arrested with a DUI before he could follow through.
Karma.
So it obviously ended up being Kelly that was kicked out of the band. Nikki Sixx, future founder of Motley Crue, auditioned to replace Kelly, but he didn't know dick about shit when it came to bass, at least at that point. They said he didn't know the notes or even how to play.
He just showed up. That seems like something Nikki Sixx would do. I'm just going to show up and see what happens.
Maybe if I dress cool enough,
they'll let me in.
Well, right. Yeah. I can't tell if he was just being ballsy showing up to an audition, not knowing how to even play an instrument.
He's a narcissist.
Or that, too. He may not have had any idea how a band worked. Like, just show up and suddenly you're in a band and you can magically play an instrument.
And you learn together.
And sing.
And, was he Nikki Sixx at this
they
point?
They already
he,
had two albums.
Nicholas Sixx. Right.
They had two albums. Like, you can't just show the fuck up.
You don't even know our songs, man. How are you going to play our song if you don't know them?
Well, either way, he obviously eventually learned something about bass and a lot about spaghetti.
Stop!
He did. Don't. we learned about something recently called the peanut butter incident with Iggy Pop.
And so we haven't talked about it yet.
We haven't talked about it, but...
We'll talk about it and do some more discovery and learning.
If somebody is sticking their dick in a jar of peanut butter.
On stage, hopefully. I don't know.
Was not thinking that, but now I'm curious.
You still loading them and heating them up with all your single shit you've been dropping. You feel me? Loading them up on. It only takes structure. And you know, just paying attention to the climate of the game.
Yeah.
Know what I mean?
So do your homies got a role in your little, you mean?
Yeah, we all artists over here, man. I'm trying to get them on there. Look, we all artists, man. You feel me? We gonna have this like,
bro, me and my man Kai, we be like, I don't know, we play with this shit right now. I gonna lie, we play with this shit right now for I gonna lie.
Don't play with it, take that shit serious.
Maybe he was slathering the peanut butter on his balls and letting the groupies lick it off. What do you think? What do you think they were doing?
Or the local stray dogs.
What do you think the peanut butter incident was, Jake? I mean, we'll find out
soon
enough.
That's a pretty good guess, yeah. We'll have to find out. Shelley, get back to the story at hand.
Okay, so instead of Nikki Sixx, Rudy Sarzo, who was a friend of Kevin's, was hired, and he can be seen on the cover of Quiet Riot 2, despite the fact that it was actually Kelly's playing on the album.
Oh, that burns.
Yeah.
That sucks.
So Kelly's still credited?
I'm not sure. I'm surprised that they didn't re-record the parts, though. But
well, you need money for that.
You need money and studio time.
Yeah. The drama of Quiet Riot was getting to be a bit much for Randy. He just wanted to shred. At the same time, overseas, Black Sabbath was dealing with a drama of their own. Ozzy Osbourne had been losing interest in the band and was curious about working with other musicians. Sabbath had a tough time recording their album, Technical Ecstasy, and their first time mixed reviews from critics certainly didn't help. In 1977, just days before entering the studio for the next recording, Ozzy up and quit the band. In his words, "The last Sabbath albums were just very depressing for me. I was doing it for the sake of what we could get out of the record company. Just to get fat on beer and to put a record out."
I don't think Ozzy Osbourne's ever been fat.
You could look up
He's
some
like
pictures.
A skinny dude.
You could look up
80s.
Some pictures.
He was a little.
He was chunky.
He was a little more full in the 80s.
Just as Ozzy was arranging things with new musicians, he changed his mind and came back to Sabbath for the very drunken, sloppy Never Say Die sessions. Van Halen opened for Sabbath that tour, and reviews were wild for the former. Critics described Sabbath as tired and uninspired. Yeah, he doesn't look fat. He just looks
He looks like
different.
Sean Astin from Lord of the Rings.
He does. For the next record cycle, Ozzy was so over it that he just refused to sing and contribute at practice. In April of 1979, Ozzy was fired for his drug and alcohol use, being replaced by Ronnie James Dio of Rainbow on vocals.
Flashback to last month's Patreon episode.
Oh yeah, we did a two-part series yep. on Patreon of singers that had been fired from their bands.
Yep.
Oh. Or not singers, but musicians who had been fired from their bands. There we go.
Does he play the devil in Tenacious?
That's Dave Grohl.
He's in Tenacious D. Yeah.
Which, thank you, Cassie, for the lovely Tenacious DVD that you gave me.
That's what they should have called
Holy
it.
Holy shit.
Anyways, so Ozzy came to L.A. in an attempt to form a new band. Dana Sturm of Slaughter harassed Randy to audition for it, who told his Quiet Riot bandmates that he didn't really want to do it. He just wanted Sturm to leave him alone. It was the last day Ozzy was in town before returning home to England. And of course, he was drunk as hell. The pair met at an L.A. studio where Rhodes brought his little practice amp and a Gibson Les Paul and started warming up. He was just practicing riffs. He, like, wasn't even doing the audition yet. But the moment that Ozzy heard Randy play, his mind was absolutely blown and Rhodes was hired immediately. Said Ozzy, "He played this fucking solo and I'm like, am I that fucking stoned or am I hallucinating or what the fuck is this?" Randy said of the audition, "I just turned up and did some riffs." And he said, "You've got the gig." I had the weirdest feeling because I thought, you didn't even hear me yet.
That's pretty wild when your warm-up arpeggios get you a job.
I get, well, that and, like, how bad was the other guitarist that he's worked with to then be like, you know what, this guy, I mean
they weren't, though. That's yeah. the thing. So it was like Tony well, Iommi like, and Black Sabbath, but it's certainly not as shreddy as what Randy Rhodes was doing.
Yeah, Randy Rhodes, he by this point, he'd been playing for well over a decade.
Yeah.
And, like, obviously he's teaching classes, so he knows what he's doing.
Yeah, he's getting better. And
Rhodes and Ozzy didn't actually get to meet that day because Ozzy stayed in the control room. So Sturm came out and let Randy know that he got the job. That didn't make it official, though, because Ozzy returned to England and continued to jam with a different guitarist. He mentioned the whole thing to his bassist, Bob Daisley, that he met a talented kid in L.A., but the group's management wanted to keep the lineup all British. They gave in eventually, and Randy flew to London's Heathrow Airport, only to come back a couple of days later. He hadn't gotten the correct work visa and was detained at the airport in a holding cell overnight and sent back to the U.S. in handcuffs, which seems excessive.
Time? Imagine
slightly.
Just, like, sitting next to a convict.
It's this dude with long hair.
No, I'm just...
The other thing is, don't tell them you're going there to work. You just go in there to
play guitar.
Some guitar and music. That's not working. That's entertainment.
Yeah, I don't know what
I don't understand the details
about.
Of this, but it's a little weird.
Yeah, so Ozzy, I mean, he got all the way there and got sent fucking back home after sleeping in a cell. Ozzy called him and apologized, arranging for the proper paperwork and then flying him back to England in November of 1979. Rhodes lived with Osborne and his then-wife, Thelma, for a few weeks. The new group was known as Blizzard of Oz, but the record company ended up using that name for their debut album, which was credited simply to Ozzy. So if you are familiar with, you know, any of this music, like Crazy Train, that's an Ozzy mm-hmm. Osbourne song. It was supposed to be a Blizzard of Oz song. This was the band's name. There's a whole bunch of shit that happened where everybody was confused, which I'll go into right now. The back cover of the first pressing of the Crazy Train single stated that the track came off of an album entitled Ozzy Osbourne / Blizzard of Oz Volume 1. When the band performed at the Reading Festival in 1980, they were billed simply as Ozzy, with that's spelled O-S-S-I-E instead of O-Z-Z-Y. Ozzy Osbourne's new band is what they put them on the lineup as. According to Daisley, when the album was released, the words Ozzy Osbourne were in bigger print than The Blizzard of Oz, which made it look like Ozzy Osbourne had an album called The Blizzard of Oz.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, Randy was never one to rock the boat. He knew he was in a situation which was a good opportunity for him, being relatively unknown. So when Lee Kerslake and I were ousted, Daisley said, Randy had no allies, and the act became Ozzy Osbourne and no longer a band. So the album was co-written by Randy and bassist Bob Daisley of Rainbow, and it was found pretty successful for Ozzy's first solo effort, becoming one of the top 100 selling albums of the 80s, even without a top 40 single. On Blizzard, Randy was able to play guitar more freely. His work had been criticized with Quiet Riot for being dull. With this new group, Rhodes could incorporate neoclassical guitar work that was a major hit with the fans. The album contains songs like Mr. Crowley and Crazy Train. And I'm officially apologizing for not knowing who Randy Rhodes was before, because I did grow up with these songs.
Yeah.
I know them as well. They got played on the regular, on the local rock stations all the time, and they still do. And I actually, since doing this episode, or, you know, researching it, I've heard it in the shop where I work.
Yeah.
Off in the distance. And I'm like, oh shit, that's fucking Randy Rhodes. Yeah. And it's like,
you're one of those nerds.
I've paid attention to, you know, because I've obviously I'm doing the research, listening to those guitar solos and riffs that I'm so familiar with from over the years. They just mean so much more and they sound so much better. Honestly.
Mm-hmm. So Mr. Crowley is in the key of D minor, while Crazy Train was in F sharp minor. Ozzy later commented, one day Randy came to me and said that most heavy metal songs are written in an A to E chord structure. He said, let's try to change that. So we made a rule that almost every number that we recorded on an album was never played in the same key. Can you imagine doing a fucking concert and having to like tune
like
your guitar
15
for each
different
song?
Guitars sitting
yeah,
there? Yeah,
or just have different guitars.
Yeah, different guitars, yeah.
Crazy Train and Crowley placed 9th and 28th on Guitar World's 100 Greatest Guitar Solos Readers Poll. According to Daisley, when the album was released, the words Ozzy Osbourne were bigger than Blizzard of Oz, which I mentioned before. Rhodes felt that he and Daisley were contributing the vast majority of the songwriting and arranging. He had little interest in performing in a backing band for someone that he felt wasn't contributing as much. So while those two guys had a lot to do with the writing on Blizzard, the guy Lee Kerslake, he came in a couple of songs after a couple of songs had already been written. Sharon Osbourne was not happy with their contributions, and she did not want them to get credit on the songs.
Who she was just
even though they did
this,
most
like,
of it. Mm-hmm. You know Ozzy didn't come up with any fucking solos. He was drunk as shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Sharon, this is just his manager at this point. They're not together. And she was like, no, they don't get credit. Meh. The album's producer, Max Norman, holds that Daisley and Kerslake did make substantial contributions, but he said that the Osbournes might want to dispute that now.
Lots of articles out there with Daisley talking about how he and Randy wrote the bulk of the music. And Daisley even says he wrote most of the lyrics.
Hmm.
So this is a quote from Daisley, I do believe. Oh, yes, it is. Randy and I would work on music together, just sitting on chairs opposite each other, and then we'd put parts together, and then we'd knock it off, and Ozzy would sing a melody over it. His melodies were always good. Ozzy's good for melodies. Usually the music came first, Ozzy would sing a melody, and then I would take the tape away into my room and write lyrics by myself to Ozzy's phrasing and melodies that would fit with what he was comfortable with. He wasn't a lyricist and neither was Randy, so I had to wear the lyricist hat. But I enjoyed it. I like writing the lyrics. That's how we wrote together.
Or separately.
This is about to get so fucked up when it comes to credits.
For them to be that casual at first, but I guess this is like leading into a bigger blow up because why wouldn't it? Give credit where credit's due.
Oh, they won't.
Oh, great.
Yeah, the credits are about to get super fucked up, and it seems like a lot of work went uncredited by Ozzy because Max, the guy who said all this shit, didn't even get credit for producing the album. To further matters, Sharon wasn't even there. So how does she know? Although she says that the recording of this album was one of the best experiences of her life, she was actually in LA and not involved yet. And Ozzy's then-wife, Thelma, was the one who was present.
Thelma,
yep. The second album with Ozzy, Diary of a Diary of a Madman, would be Rhodes' last. He had just been voted Best New Talent by Guitar Player magazine and Best Heavy Metal Guitarist with the UK Sounds magazine. While the success with Ozzy was popping off, Randy did a one-off show reuniting with Quiet Riot at the Whiskey A Go-Go in Hollywood. His manager and Ozzy's future wife, Sharon Arden, warned him never to do something like that again.
I think I found the problem.
Was he under contract with Ozzy?
No.
So then what's the problem?
Well, so her idea is that he is so famous. I mean, he's coming off of Black Sabbath. He is like the guy. How dare you go play with another band? Kind of. I hate to say it. Like Metallica with Jason Newsted.
He wanted
to go play with his other band, and they were like, bitch, we're Metallica.
Hetfield was not happy about that.
Oh, they were pissed. And then he ended up leaving the band because he was like, sure, you are the biggest metal band in the world, but I like doing other shit.
Yeah.
Yep.
So it was one of those situations. But there was also something we talked about recently with Sharon Osbourne where she was being a dick to somebody and was like, you better not do that. Do you remember what that was?
Oh, that was Rob Trujillo.
Oh, yeah, because he was with Suicidal Tendencies, which was also under her management, and he went and played with Metallica.
He actually played with Ozzy as well.
Oh, yeah, and then Sharon was like...
And she was like warning him, like, don't go with those guys, they're bad news, and she's trying to prevent him from joining Metallica.
Yeah, what a... Anyways... let's see. Okay, so Sharon also suddenly fired two of the guys in Ozzy's band. So Rudy Sarzo, the guy who took over bass in Quiet Riot, followed Randy over to Ozzy's new band. According to the fired drummer Lee Kerslake, Randy almost quit the band as well because he didn't want to go on tour with Osbourne. The ex-bandmates, though, encouraged him to stay.
Quote from Kerslake, Randy said to me, I'll leave if you want me to. I don't want to stay in this without you too, him and the other guy that got fired. That's how close we were, I said. Randy, this is going to go through the roof. These two albums are going to sell millions. Trust me. Stay with it, mate, and good luck to you. I wish I hadn't said that now. He'd still be alive. That's a quote from Kerslake.
Yeah, you can't look at it like that.
It's, well, yeah, he's looking at it hindsight, but also...
Because he was about to quit, yeah.
At the time, for a bandmate that gets fired, and you got another guy that's about to follow you, and you're like, no, stay here, this is a good thing, you're going to explode, this is going to be phenomenal for
especially
you.
Especially
because
he was just a
kid,
and they all knew how talented he was,
right.
And they were like, you can't quit, you're playing with the biggest act there
right.
is. Like, you need
to
do this
it.
For you.
Yep.
Yeah, so Randy brought a lot of his early Quiet Riot riffs over as his original band was dissolving. And as Sarzo said, a lot of the Quiet Riot songs ended up on the Osbourne albums under different titles. Obviously, Randy thought we'd never use those songs again, so he'd give the riffs to Ozzy, who'd come up with new words. If you wanted to hear an example, the main riff on the Osbourne song Suicide Solution originated as a secondary riff during the verse of a Quiet Riot demo recording entitled force of habit. Hmm. As far as Quiet Riot went, DeBrow stayed and recruited a new lineup. Rhodes gave him permission to continue on with the same name, as long as Sarzo was cool with it too, and Quiet Riot was revived after a 2-year hiatus. There were more issues with songwriting credits on Diary of a Madman, as the new members were credited for songs that Bob Daisley and Lee Kerslake had written and played on the album, like Flying High Again and Over the Mountain. The new drummer, Tommy Aldridge, said of the matter, "I think it's pretty obvious that it's not my drumming on that album. I have never taken credit for that recording, and I've always given Lee Kerslake, whenever asked or interviewed, the credit he rightly deserves." Also, Don Airey was credited on the keys, while it was actually Johnny Cook who played the keyboard parts. Don Airey wasn't even available when they were recording because he was on tour with Rainbow.
Yeah, I get the feeling that Sharon is probably the one mostly to blame for that.
But I'm like, where are they coming up with these names? Like, when it comes down, who wrote them down and handed them to somebody? Because how did this guy's name get on the list when he was on tour with another band at that time? Like,
also,
how fucking
was he
dumb?
Getting royalties? Like, she seems messy.
I don't know. A little bit,
yeah.
I don't know. This whole thing is like, what the hell is going on?
How did she get started? That should be a...
Because her dad was a... Her dad owned a label or a management company. Because I thought I mentioned it at some point in here, but Sharon wasn't their original manager.
No,
it was,
not at the beginning, no.
It was her dad or her brother or something. The recording of Diary of a Madman was also a pain in the dick. The guys weren't given any money to live on, so they went to management to discuss that. And around that time, Sharon actually became the manager after her brother David decided he didn't want to handle it anymore. He had too much work to do for his dad in the office. According to Kerslake, she came in and it started to get edgy. But we never suspected a thing until we went away on holiday. Next minute, they're rehearsing with Tommy Aldridge and Rudy Sarzo and going to America. The album got positive reviews, most of them giving praise to Randy. According to Steve Huey of AllMusic, it's not uncommon to find fans who prefer Diary to Blizzard, since it sets an even more mystical, eerie mood, and since Rhodes' playing is progressing to an even higher level. BBC Music referred to the album as a classic rock record in every way, lifted out of the ordinary by the legendary rock ex-god, Randy Rhodes. Canadian journalist Martin Popoff declared Diary of a Madman a lasting classic that stands as the definitive showcase for Randy Rhodes. So everybody fucking loves this guy. Randy did entertain the thought of leaving the music scene for a while to get his degree in classical guitar at UCLA. He decided to fulfill his contract with Ozzy. Despite abusing drugs and alcohol and making life generally difficult for those around him, Ozzy and Randy were on relatively good terms. And I would like to clarify, the alcohol and drug abuse
Ozzy.
Is on the part
Ozzy.
Of Ozzy.
Obviously.
Not Randy.
Have you seen that man? Yeah.
Randy was basically just getting tired of Ozzy's unreliability. He would go overboard on substances with a show the next day and then cancel last minute because he felt like shit. Sometimes Sharon could get him out on stage, but many shows were simply canceled.
I'm surprised he was, still able to keep, I don't think he's actively still touring or doing
anything
like
that. No, he's not.
Because he had to stop, right?
Yeah, he's in very poor health right now.
I'm surprised he was able to keep up that facade as long as he was with the cancellations. Because after like a certain point, people are just going to start expecting it and just not come to your shows or buy your tickets.
I think it's good that social media didn't exist back then because it would take is one or two videos of shows being canceled.
Yeah.
And everyone would be like, cool, not buying tickets for that. Yep. But I don't think that news was traveling like that back then.
Yeah. People next town over, they're not going to know.
They're not going to know. They're not going to hear about what happened at the show before unless they like talk to someone on the phone or if it's on the news. And that would be crazy if it was.
They're not going
to
put that on the news unless something weird happened.
Yeah. So like, I don't know. He canceled so many shows. It was ridiculous.
Sure, weird things did happen.
Oh, we'll talk about them now. How about that? The Diary of a Madman tour started off in Germany to sold out venues. But after the group's performance on November 13th, Sharon canceled the rest of the European tour because of Ozzy's mental health issues. His marriage to Thelma was falling apart, so Sharon took him to England and checked him into a mental health facility.
I mean, at least she did that.
It was nice of her, but what the fuck do you see in this guy? Like,
I can fix him.
Yeah. She just wanted somebody that she could boss around all the time, and, like, he was the guy. On November 22nd, the group came together for rehearsals while Ozzy was still in the hospital. They were able to perform again by November 29th, but after a couple of shows, they canceled the rest of their European tour again.
Imagine having tickets to this show in the middle of this tour.
One day.
It's like, it's actually canceled, and then he comes back. You're like, oh, I can go. It's not canceled. And they're like, actually, no, it's canceled again. Hello. Goodbye.
At least they were physical tickets, so you just have it, like, on your wall, and then you pull it off your wall and put it in your wallet, and then you put it back on the wall.
Yeah.
And then you put it in your wallet, and then it goes back on the wall. In January of 1982, the band attempted to embark on their North American tour. At a show in Des Moines, or Des Moines.
If you say it like a nerd.
Yeah.
Des Moines. Des Moines.
One of the most infamous Ozzy stories unfolded.
We've gone over this.
As the band performed at the Des Moines Veterans Memorial Auditorium, a fan threw a dead bat on stage.
Allegedly.
Where did he get that? He stole it from the science department of a local high school.
Allegedly.
As one does.
Ozzy picked up the carcass and, believing it was a toy, took a big old bite out of the creature's wing before throwing it back into the audience. Following the show, Osbourne was checked into the hospital to receive rabies shots. 6 days later in Illinois, Ozzy collapsed on stage. That's Illinois. Mm-hmm. Sorry. Ozzy collapsed on stage as a result of an illness caused by the rabies shots.
Illinois.
He was pulled off stage, brought back to the hospital, and the rest of the show was canceled.
Didn't see that coming.
Nope. The straw that broke the camel's back there for Randy came in February of 1982. Ozzy's management and label wanted them to record a live album, but of Black Sabbath songs, which Randy and Tommy Aldridge, the new member, it seemed like a cover album to them. They were like, we didn't write this shit. No, it was a slap in the face to their integrity as artists and professional musicians, and they refused to participate. This irked Ozzy, and he interpreted it as betrayal.
Wouldn't he also need permission from Sabbath to record all of that again? Like,
well, I think that Ozzy would be getting credit, but they wouldn't.
Yeah.
Because it would be the original members who wrote it that would be getting credit. And, like, so fuck that. Nah.
He wants a bigger name. Mm.
Yeah, so that February 19th is described in mini number 15. This is when the group, or mini episode that we did way back in the day, the group had been in Texas. Sharon hid all of Ozzy's clothes in an attempt to keep him from drinking because he's all pissed off that these guys won't record this album with him. So he decided to put on Sharon's nightgown, get drunk, and then peed on the Alamo before getting arrested. Sharon was able to get him released in time for his show at the San Antonio Convention Center Arena.
And just for clarification, he didn't pee on the Alamo itself, but he did pee on a monument on the Alamo grounds out
same
in front
thing.
Of it. Close.
Same thing, right?
I'm just...
It was like a fountain.
No, it was just a big granite monument thing.
But did he remember?
Probably not.
I don't think he did. I don't think he did.
Yeah, I'm sure he was blackout.
Everyone was pretty much fed up with Ozzy's shit, except for Sharon, I guess. This didn't seem to slow down his drinking, though. At one point, he fired the entire band, but he didn't even remember that he did it. Ozzy started talking shit to Randy, saying that Frank Zappa or even Gary Moore from Skid Row and Thin Lizzy would be happy to replace him. Rhodes was so over it, he decided to leave and unhappily played the live album to fulfill his contract of one more record and tour. The live album, however, wasn't going to come out. Randy unexpectedly died several weeks later. Randy Rhodes played his final show in Knoxville to a sold-out crowd on March 18th of 1982. On their way to Rock Super Bowl 14.
Yep.
In Orlando, Florida. That is XIV.
Roman numerals.
Call IXII.
Is that a Hercules reference?
Yes, it is.
Randy scolded Ozzy for his heavy drinking, saying, "You'll kill yourself, you know, one of these days."
Yeah, by all accounts I've read, Randy didn't do drugs. He was a smoker and drank a little bit, but that's about it. He was more focused on the music and, you know, putting in the work, you know, even back in his Quiet Riot days.
Yeah, that's good. He never some people get a little taste of fame and then they go overboard in the, like, I'm a rock star and indulging in that lifestyle. And that never
happened to Randy.
Yeah, he always had a really good work ethic. Yeah. The band's next date was headlining the Rock Super Bowl, as we said, in Orlando, Florida, March 20th. But their bus broke down. Sounds familiar. They stopped at Flying Baron Estates outside of Leesburg, Florida for repairs.
Okay, I looked this place up, and it's one of those quote-unquote neighborhoods where rich people have houses basically lining a runway, and they can pull their plane out of the garage and go flying pretty much whenever they want. It turns out there's a place there that fixes big tour buses, too. It's I don't know if they sell them or it's just like a repair depot, but you can see it if you look it up on Google Maps. You can zoom in and you can see all the buses sitting there. You can actually see the area where things are about to go down here.
Yeah, it's, you pulled it up and you showed me those houses were huge, and they...
There are a couple big mansions there, and they got some big hangars out there.
Yeah, their main street is really just like an airstrip.
Yeah, it's just one straight, I don't know, maybe quarter mile or something. And
yeah, so that's where they are. And at the time, Ozzy, Sharon, Rudy, and Tommy, they were all asleep on the bus. Randy, Don Airey, and the rest of the crew were awake and started checking out the airstrip and the hangar full of airplanes there. The group's bus driver, Andrew Acock, claimed that he was also an experienced pilot. He took a Beechcraft Bonanza F-35, sounds familiar, out of the hangar, and he started offering flights to those people who were awake. And if you also thought it sounded familiar, Cassie, that is because that's the very same plane we talked about that took out Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, the Big Bopper, and their pilot, Roger Peterson, February 3rd of 1959. We covered that on episode 1.
I just want to know who owned this plane that this man A, found the keys for and was able to just like whip it out in the middle of the night.
Don't think they have keys.
Planes what? Don't have keys?
I don't believe so.
What?
So you could just steal the plane?
If you
just
you have know to know how to fire it up, if you know how to start it.
Planes don't have keys.
I don't think the 747 or whatever
snakes
it was.
Don't have
sorry.
Bones?
Yeah. No, snakes have bones.
When did we have that conversation?
We did it. It's a thing I say every time that I say something that might be obvious because
had that conversation.
Oh, because I literally didn't know snakes had bones at one point because I'm stupid.
Oh, okay.
Planes don't have keys and snakes have bones. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't think 747s have a set of keys. You gotta
they should.
Make sure the pilot has them.
I guess they don't because imagine how confusing that would get for all the pilots at the airport to have to change
keys.
Yeah,
it's not like a car rental place.
All right.
Anyways.
So
small private planes have ignition keys, but I guess a Bonanza wouldn't.
Possibly. It could be too old for that. Maybe.
Either way, it doesn't matter. He didn't have permission. That's the long and short
of it. The takeaway is he stole this plane.
Without permission, Acock took the plane out with Don Airey and the tour manager, Jake Duncan. I guess he was trying to prank the guys on the bus by flying low and waking them up. He thought that would be fun.
So funny.
So once they landed, Duncan said that Acock was going to take Rachel Youngblood, who was the group's hairdresser and makeup artist, and the reason behind those beautiful feathers in their hair. He was going to take her up for a ride, and he said he would take it easy because she had a heart condition, which is really the only reason why Randy agreed to go. He was scared of flying, but he wanted to take some pictures for his mom. Randy tried to get Rudy Sarzo up on the plane as well, but he wisely chose to go into the bus and get some sleep. So it's about 10 a.m. The plane had been in the air for about 5 minutes. Acock did some more low-flying buzzes past the tour bus, and after 2 successful passes, the small plane clipped its right wing on the bus, leading the wing to snap into 2 pieces while the plane spiraled out of control. The plane severed the top of a pine tree and ultimately crashed into the garage of a nearby mansion. It then burst into flames and killed all 3 aboard. Randy Rhodes was only 25 years old at the time of the crash, March 19th, 1982. The only person who actually saw the crash was Don Airey. He was standing by the bus taking pictures to give Randy later. His eyewitness account described this. I had my camera and was taking photos of the plane to give to Randy afterwards. I had my telephoto lens on and could tell that there was some sort of struggle going on aboard the plane. The wings were rapidly tipping from side to side. At one point, the plane almost became perpendicular, no more than 6 feet off the ground. That's when I put down my camera and saw the plane right in front of me. I quickly crouched to avoid getting hit and looked over my shoulder and watched it clip the bus, crash into the tree, and explode on impact into the garage. The bodies were burned beyond recognition, identified by dental records and jewelry. Sharon had been asleep on the bus but was awoken by the chaos outside, saying, "They were all in bits. It was just body parts everywhere." The band and crew on the bus shook themselves awake. Sarzo stepped over broken glass in his bare feet to see a giant hole in the bus. Jake Duncan rocked back and forth outside, screaming, "They're gone." Tommy found a fire extinguisher and ran towards the flaming plane. Mm. Jake Duncan had been slightly concerned about the pilot's behavior on the first flight, remarking that it did get scary flying close to the bus, but it all seemed innocent. Later in his autopsy, Acock tested positive for cocaine,
of course,
while Rhodes only had nicotine in his system. Acock's aviation certificate had also expired, and it also wasn't the first time he'd been involved in a fatal crash. 6 years prior, in the UAE, was his previous crash, which Sharon reportedly knew about before hiring him.
Oh.
So.
Yeah, from my understanding, and this comes from the YouTube channel that we mentioned at the beginning of the show, part of his certification had expired, specifically the medical portion, which I would assume you have to have some sort of current physical on file that says you're fit to operate a plane. That piece had expired.
Huh.
It also had been determined that he hadn't flown in quite some time. Things are really stacking up against Acock here. Not only was he coked up and running on no sleep, he stole a plane that hadn't been flown in a year and had not had its annual inspection. They have to get inspected every year, basically.
I didn't even think about that.
It's like a state inspection. So, yeah, so he just wandered off, found this airplane sitting in a hangar that nobody had used in a year, hadn't been looked at, hadn't been checked over for safety
and
stuff.
And he hadn't even spoken
hopped
to
in,
anybody.
Fired it up and just, yeah. You know, God. It's not something I think they really expect people to do is just hop off a bus, you know, right. And
I
steal
hate
one
that
of
they got
planes.
In with him. Yeah. I hate that they did that.
He was on coke.
If I am aware that anybody is under the influence of anything, I am not going anywhere with you.
Maybe they didn't know.
For any reason.
The fact that he just got into a random plane that he had no idea what condition it was. It would be different if the owner was out there and was like, "Oh yeah, it's all up to whatever." You have no idea. You don't know if
you still have to do your pre-flight checks and shit like that.
Yeah,
there's a logbook for that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
every time you go up, you got to go. Yeah, he didn't do any of that.
That's
shit. He
so
just hopped
insane.
In.
Like,
yeah, let's go. Bye. No
craziness. Later on, it came out that Acock's estranged wife Wanda spent the night on the bus. Everyone present was aware that he was trying to get back together with her, and he was described as being agitated in the hours before the crash. Wanda allegedly came out of the bus right before the second flight took off and was standing in the doorway of the bus when he flew by that last time. Ari and Sarzo speculated that Acock, hopped up on coke and sleep-deprived, may have snapped and decided to kill Wanda, and that's why he flew the plane there, and that Randy's tussle in the cockpit could have prevented a direct hit with the bus, saving everyone on board. Ozzy's official statement to investigators was, "At approximately 9 a.m. on Friday, March 19th, 1982, I was awoken from my sleep by a loud explosion. I immediately thought that we'd hit a vehicle on the road. I got out of the bed, screaming to my fiance Sharon, 'Get off the bus.' Meanwhile, she was screaming to everyone else to get off the bus. After getting out of the bus, I saw that a plane had crashed. I didn't know who was on the plane at the time. When we realized that our people were on the plane, I found it very difficult to get assistance from anyone to help. In fact, it took almost a half hour before anyone arrived. One small fire engine arrived that appeared to squirt 3 gallons of water over the inferno. We asked for further assistance, such as telephones, and didn't receive any further help. In the end, we finally found a telephone and Sharon phoned her father." Randy had a longtime girlfriend named Jody Raskin who found out about his death, much the same that Buddy Holly's wife did. by listening to music in her car. A block of songs from Blizzard of Oz came on, followed by the DJ announcing news of the accident and Rose's death. Rudy Sarzo said that the band and crew had called their family members first before news outlets were notified of the casualties. He wandered into a nearby church to pray, where one man was sitting at the front and crying uncontrollably. That man was Ozzy Osbourne. Following the accident, Ozzy fell deeper into depression and the record company gave him a break from performing. He said it was all over and he never wanted to play again. Sharon got him back working in no time. Ozzy was quoted on David Letterman a week after the incident saying, "You can't kill rock and roll." Rudy Sarzo recruited his younger brother Robert to replace Randy on guitar. He asked Robert to audition and play exactly as Randy did, and he was hired. However, Bernie Torme, I believe is how you say his name. Bernie Torme had already been hired by Sharon's father, despite his poor audition due to unfamiliarity with the material and the style of Rhodes. Ozzy's new lineup was back on the road by March 29th, just over a month after Randy's death. Ultimately, Torme did not stay with the band. Brad Gillis, or Gillis, began to audition, unfamiliar with Black Sabbath, but able to faithfully reproduce Rhodes' guitar parts. He joined up with the group that April, and a few months later, they'd continue to work on a new live album, Speak of the Devil. Morale was incredibly low after the loss of Rhodes. Osbourne was nowhere to be found while recording, which obviously pissed off the band. Gillis, Sarzo, and Aldridge were given 5 days to learn the songs, not including Iron Man, Children of the Grave, and Paranoid, for which they had previous live recordings featuring Rhodes. During this time, Sarzo had secretly been recording the Mental Health sessions with Quiet Riot, and he made his final decision to leave Osbourne's band.
So that is the era of Quiet Riot that I'm familiar with. I think probably most everybody else, because they didn't actually become popular until, unfortunately, after Randy passed away. Speaking of, to turn it up to a lighter note, did you know that Metal Health, Bang Your Head, was featured in a song called Hooked on Polkas? It's a polka medley arranged by Weird Al in his 1985 album, Dare to be Stupid.
I did not know that.
Well, now you do.
The remaining live recordings for Speak of the Devil came from two sloppy shows at the Ritz, where Ozzy could barely remember the lyrics and the band had only run through the songs a couple of times in rehearsal without him. According to the album's producer, Max Norman, no word on if he was credited again, he had Ozzy and the group perform a whole extra show without the audience there so that he could add in crowd noise post-production.
Can you imagine going to that show and then being told, like, hey, it's going to be a live recording, and then the band sucks, and you're like, what the fuck is this?
And then you go back
and you
hear
go and
the
buy
album.
The album, and you're like, this didn't even happen
this
like this.
This is not
That's
how it
so
sounded.
Funny. That's so...
So stupid.
I hate that.
Like, at that point, just do a studio recording.
Yeah. Say it was live when it was in the studio.
Right. Soon, Sarzo officially left for Quiet Riot, and Gillis left to release Night Ranger's debut album.
Just a question.
Ozzy, my karaoke song. Ozzy released Tribute in 1987, an album dedicated to Randy Rhodes featuring his artwork with the band, as well as a song, D, that Randy had written for his mother. Randy is buried at the Mountain View Cemetery in San Bernardino, California, his tomb inscribed with an inspiration for all young people. And he was. His neoclassical style inspired the likes of Dimebag Darrell, John Petrucci of Gene Dream Theater, Zakk Wylde, Buckethead, Tom Morello of Rage Against the Machine, Mike McCready of Pearl Jam, and so many more. Those who worked with Randy called him inspirational and life-changing. His bandmate Aldridge said, "Guys like that, they kind of grab you by the scruff of your neck and lift you up to their level."
I think that may have been the teacher in him. He's trying to show people what he does. And definitely have some newfound respect for his work and on his two albums with Ozzy. Like, now when I hear Crazy Train, I mentioned earlier, or Mr. Crowley, like, it won't just be because it's on in the background somewhere. Like, I'll actually stop and listen to it because of Randy.
Yeah.
To hear his stuff.
Yeah, well, 'cause I didn't know shit about him before, really.
I didn't either.
And I don't like Ozzy. So it's like I wouldn't listen to these songs because I find Ozzy Osbourne's voice really annoying. Sorry for anyone who's that. Screaming at their like listening device. I just don't like him. And like now learning about more about him and his stupid wife, like I just don't like them as people. And I think now when I hear the songs, I can listen to them. And instead of hearing Ozzy, hear Randy.
Right.
And hear his playing.
Exactly.
Because that's something I had never really paid attention to.
Me neither.
Randy Rhoads was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2021 by Ozzy, Tom Morello, Zakk Wylde, and Kirk Hammett, receiving the Musical Excellence Award. Blizzard of Oz and Diary of a Madman were controversially re-released in 2002, with the original bass and drum tracks replaced by newly recorded parts from bassist Robert Trujillo and drummer Mike Bordin. This greatly pissed off the fans, so the original bass and drum tracks were reinstated for the 2011 release.
Neither version available on Spotify. I looked. Just the 2020 40th anniversary version. Also, I wondered what Rob had thought of that, and here's a quote transcribed from an interview on an episode of The Vinyl Guide. "Well, that's a weird situation," he says. "I didn't even know what we were doing. It was like I was asked to do this session, and then we were doing it, but I don't even know why we were doing it. I was employed by Sharon and Ozzy at the time, so I just did what I was told to do, and I didn't look into it too deep.
That's how they like it.
In fact, I forget about it. I forget that even happened, and I wasn't sure if there were any other plans playing on it, too. So I didn't put a lot of thought into that. I mean, at the time, I would have definitely tried to play as close to what he and Daisley did and definitely try not to bring me into that."
The whole replacement probably happened because Daisley and Kerslake had successfully sued Sharon Osbourne for songwriting credits and royalties for their contributions on Diary of a Madman. They suspected their parts were re-recorded in retaliation. Sharon later stated that Ozzy and not herself was responsible for the decision to re-record their parts, stating, "Because of Daisley and Kerslake's abusive and unjust behavior, Ozzy wanted to remove them from these recordings. We turned a negative into a positive by adding a fresh sound to the original albums." However, Osbourne contradicted this claim in his 2009 autobiography, stating that the decision to re-record the original bass and drum parts was strictly Sharon's decision, and that, quote, "I didn't have anything to do with that decision. He said his wife just snapped and had it done without his knowledge. It sounds like it's within her character."
Yeah.
He also stated that a sticker was put on the covers telling everyone about it, though in fact the sticker was not initially placed on the reissue and was only placed on the covers at a later date because the fans were pissed off over the altered recordings.
They didn't know about it. And then the other one was like,
they were like, "Wait a minute.
Actually,
wait a
this
goddamn
sounds
minute.
Different."
Yeah. So
I
they
don't
knew.
Know this version.
So that is episode 1, season 6, Randy Rhoads in the books. And
wow.
A lot of respect for that, dude. We're going to have to put together a playlist for you guys. It'll be in the show description so you can go listen to that. And if, I don't know, even though they're always in the show descriptions, people seem to have a hard time finding them. So if you are having trouble finding it, we do have a Facebook group where we've got some different links to our profile on Spotify that has all of the playlists. So go to our Facebook group. It's called Death by Music Podcast Fans. You can talk about the episode, chat with your homies, talk shit. We don't care. Whatever.
Don't talk shit about me.
If you enjoy the show, please review us on Spotify. We would like 5 stars, please. Now, we've got more episodes coming up this year. Next for February is going to be Joseph Ballon, who is a French composer from the 1700s after Jean-Baptiste Lully, little bit before Mozart. Mozart is actually kind of in his story. And the interesting thing about this guy is that he was black. And he was a legit composer. They let him do that, kind of.
What the fuck?
I thought it was fake. I just found a movie.
I didn't honestly know that.
Yeah.
That's
you ever heard of a black composer? In the fucking 1700s.
No. That let alone. Does not happen.
Yeah, I saw a movie, and I thought that the movie was just like a historical drama, And this dude's like friends with Marie Antoinette and is trying to be the lead of the Paris Opera, which Lully was for a while. He was trying to take it over years after. And I was like, this is fiction, right? Like, this is not real.
Historical fiction.
And then I looked it up and I'm like, holy shit, this guy is real. And the movie was actually pretty accurate.
What was the movie called?
Chevalier. Yeah, he actually had a title. And I mean, he had a whole bunch of shit in his life because it was like, do we like him or do we hate him? Because he was so talented and he's his dad. I mean, I don't want to give the whole story away, but he was insanely skilled.
Sure.
And so I feel like the French aristocracy at the time, they were like, we'll make an exception. But anytime he actually started to gain some real power, they were like, we should knock him down a few notches.
Oh, humble him. He's not that great.
But he was insanely skilled. Yeah. And he was one of Mozart's inspirations. So I found the episode super fucking interesting.
Cool. I'm excited.
That's coming out in February. And if you want to check out the movie, I believe it's on Hulu. It's called Chevalier. And so, we're doing another composer. So thanks to whoever initially suggested composers, because I just love throwing them in.
Yeah.
For some different type of shit. All right. Thank you guys for listening. You want extra content? Go to Patreon. It's patreon.com/deathbypodcastteam. $5 a month. You get 2 extra episodes. We got like 60 up there right now. Cassie's getting up and leaving.
My ass hurts.
Yeah. Mine too. All right. Thank you guys for listening. Rest in peace.
Rip.
Whoa. Later.
Give a proper goodbye. Yeah.
Bye.
Death by Music podcast is written and produced by Alex Motler, Cassie Gardner, and Jake.